Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. As tensions rise between China and Taiwan, we sit down in this episode with Hal Brands, co-author of Danger Zone, The Coming Conflict with China. Brands and his co-author Michael Beckley, both scholars at the American Enterprise Institute, argue that China is a peaking power and that regional and global aggression is a gamble President Xi and the Communist Party would be willing to make to counter a decline. Brands argues that the next decade will be a pivotal one in U.S.-Chinese relations with global consequences.
Hal Brands, your new book is titled Danger Zone, The Coming Conflict with China. If the United States and China, or the West and China, are on a collision course, what's the root of it?
Well, it's a complicated question, and I think the answer has to do with China's power trajectory on the one hand and its ambitions on the other. And so what we've seen over the last 25 years is that China has articulated more and more grandiose aims as to what it wants to accomplish in the world, everything from unifying Taiwan with Taiwan, which is obviously a long-standing objective of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, to establishing itself as the primary power in Asia and perhaps around the globe. That's something that often happens as countries rise in power. Their ambitions grow as well. And so in a lot of ways, that's not surprising. I think what's particularly important to note, though, is that China's trajectory has changed over the past 15 years. China is no longer rising as effortlessly as it once was, particularly in the economic realm. It is no longer enjoying such a welcoming embrace from the world. It's generating more and more resistance among countries that are opposed to the expansion of its influence. And so China is now best classified as a peaking power, a country that has really formidable capabilities. It's continuing to develop more formidable coercive capabilities, military power in particular, but that's its days of easiest growth are behind it. And so our concern, which we write about in the book, is that as China starts to worry that its long-term trajectory is looking more uncertain, it may be more inclined to use force and aggression to seize what it wants in the here and now.
So there's a lot to unpack in that response, but before we get into some of those things, I also wanted to ask, because you didn't really, you alluded to it, but didn't mention it, besides the regional power or their economic goals, there's an ideological bent to all of this that Xi has been speaking about and other members of the CCP. Can you discuss really the clash of ideologies?
I think that's really at the root of what we're seeing today. And so China and the United States are not just two countries in the international system. They're two countries that come from very different ideological perspectives. And so the United States obviously is a democratic superpower. And as Americans, because we think that's normal, we often forget how profoundly that influences our approach to international affairs. It's not a coincidence that the United States has among its core allies mostly liberal democracies. It's not a coincidence that the United States thinks it will be safer and more influential in a world in which democracy is widespread and respect for human rights is widespread. Countries typically believe that they will be better off in a world that reflects their own ideological and governance perspectives at home. That's an old story in international affairs. And we can see it increasingly on the Chinese side as well. It's very difficult for the Chinese Communist Party to feel secure in a system that is led by a democratic superpower because the CCP worries that the norms of what's often called the liberal international order could be fatal to the illiberal rule of the Chinese Communist Party within China. That they worry that democratic countries will exert pressure on China to recognize basic human rights, not to repress its population, to change the way it does business domestically. And so as China's become more powerful, it's also become more assertive in trying to create an international system where autocracy is at the very least protected. We see that in the way that China interacts with international institutions. We see that in the way that China tries to censor critiques of its foreign policy and its domestic practices abroad. And so there is this fundamental tension between liberal and illiberal systems of government that drives a lot of the international tension we see today.
You ask in the introduction why you would be publishing a book like this when there's a hot war going on between Russia and Ukraine, really Russia and the West. So what's the answer to that?
So Russia invaded Ukraine in late February, which is just as we were moving into the proof stage of this book. And I say we because I should mention that this is a co-authored book. My colleague, Mike Beckley, is my partner in crime on this one. And it became clear, obviously, that this war was going to be captivating the world's attention in a pretty significant way and potentially drawing attention away from the challenge that China presents in the Western Pacific. But in our view, you can't look at these things in isolation. It is going to be difficult for the United States to be effective against China if it has a gaping wound in Eastern Europe created by successful Russian aggression there. But at the same time, the United States is going to be needing to ensure that the whatever precedent Putin is able to set in Ukraine does not encourage aggression in the Western Pacific. And so in some ways, it's particularly important now to focus on particularly the military challenge that China poses, because this is something that's coming at us sooner rather than later. We think this is a challenge that could hit the United States and its allies in the face in the next 3 to 5 years. And so even as we deal with the problem of Russian aggression in Ukraine, it's important to keep our eye on the ball in the Western Pacific.
So while you mentioned Mike Beckley, would you talk about what he brings to the table and what you do, what your different areas of expertise are?
Sure. So Mike is a political scientist who focuses on international relations and has quite a lot of expertise on China. He's lived there, he speaks the language, and he's followed Chinese politics, the Chinese economy, for a long time. I pay attention to those issues too, obviously. I'm actually a historian by trade, though, and I came up studying the history of the Cold War and the history of great power rivalry. And so this book is a collaboration that tries to bring together strengths in a few different areas, everything from how the international system tends to change when great powers rise or peak to the particulars of China's trajectory today. And we hope that we bring complementary expertise to these issues.
What's the birth story of this particular book?
So Mike and I actually met each other almost a decade ago on a trip to Israel, but we got the idea for this book in a seminar that we were doing at the American Enterprise Institute, where we are both fellows, about 2 years ago. Mike was presenting a paper that he had written on what happens when countries that have been growing really, really fast slow down. And the punchline basically is that they become more internationally aggressive and more repressive at home when they do so. When he was presenting that paper, I remember that I had written a paper about a year before, which was really kind of a thought experiment on why we ought to be as worried about the decline of Russia and China as we ought to be worried about their ascent and the sort of aggression they might engage in as they worried that their time horizons were running short. And so we started talking about the project, realized we were on a similar wavelength, and we wrote a short article laying out some of the key themes a couple of years ago, and it developed into the book project.
So your theory of China as a peaking power is a contrarian one. What's the conventional view?
I think the conventional view is that China is the world's next superpower, that it's going to overtake the United States economically at some point in the next decade, that it's going to perhaps overtake the United States militarily over a longer time frame, and that China is on path to becoming number one in the international system, just as the United States became number one in the international system during the 20th century. Our argument is that this is the wrong way of thinking about it, that China is not actually going to overtake the United States as a global superpower. Its rise has been phenomenal. Its rise has been very impressive over the last 45 years or so. But it's no longer rising at a clip that would allow it to clearly supersede the United States. Chinese economic growth has been slowing for about 15 years now, even before COVID set in. There are some deep, long-term structural economic problems that I think the Chinese government will have a very hard time overcoming. And when you add in the fact that it's not just the United States, it's the United States plus all of its allies in Asia and elsewhere, the idea that China is going to emerge as the superpower of this century just doesn't strike us as particularly plausible. What we do worry about is that China will be poised to challenge the United States and its allies in particular areas. So to overturn the military balance of power in the Western Pacific, where China has geographic advantages because it's close and we're far, or to carve out a technological sphere of influence encompassing most of the developing world, and that China's incentive to do this, to behave in a more risk-prone fashion will actually grow as Chinese leaders, Xi Jinping and those around him, realize that China doesn't have all of the time in the world to accomplish its objectives.
Understanding that we don't get to see much in the West about their thinking, are there evidential strains that the CCP leaders understand that their best times may be behind them?
I think there is a great deal of circumstantial evidence to this effect. And so if you run the thought experiment, it's kind of hard to imagine Xi Jinping giving a speech where he says, China's future looks really bad. There are a lot of economic problems I don't know how to solve. My policies have engendered fear and resistance around the world, and so I better start moving fast to accomplish these things before I take China off the rails. You're just not going to see that, obviously, in any political system, let alone an authoritarian political system. But you can see a handful of indications that the Chinese leadership realizes that the future may not be so bright. And so there have been remarkably candid statements about the problems within the Chinese economy going back at least a decade and a half, and I think those have been accumulating over time. You see a number of Chinese foreign policy observers making what are sometimes veiled critiques of Xi's policies and pointing out that China is well on its way to provoking the hostility of a massive international coalition whose combined strength it cannot possibly overcome. You've seen Xi Jinping himself give internal speeches that have subsequently been leaked and reported in the West, where he warns about the dangers of a Soviet-style collapse and cautions that China has to triple down on internal discipline and repression in order to avert that. And then you can also see it in some of the things that have happened more recently. And so just earlier this month, there was obviously a military crisis in the Taiwan Strait after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited, and that was an opportunity, certainly, for the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, to demonstrate the capabilities that it's built over the last 20 years. But it was also clearly provoked, in a sense, by a worry that Taiwan is slipping away from China, that fewer and fewer people on Taiwan want anything to do with unification with China, that Taiwan develops more and more of a distinct national identity every year, that countries around the world are opening up their relationships with Taiwan because they worry about China's assertive behavior. And so you can see this mix of confidence and anxiety that can be pretty potent.
What are some historical antecedents for your peaking power theory?
So there are quite a number of them. And so we mention a few in the book. There's a longer study that Mike has done, which basically looks at every peaking power over the past 150 years. So these were countries that were growing significantly faster than the global average over an extended period and then slowed down. And in virtually every case, you see these countries become more aggressive and repressive, although it varies depending on which country you're talking about. The two that we really focus in on in the book are Germany prior to World War I and Japan prior to World War II. The Germany-UK relationship in the late 19th and early 20th centuries is often held up as an analog for the U.S.-China relationship today. You had the liberal superpower of the day confronting the more autocratic challenger of the day. What's really interesting in terms of the parallel, in our view, is that Germany was another example of a power that had peaked and began to act more aggressively. And so Germany had been going gangbusters for 35, 40 years after unification in 1870, 71. But by the time you get to the eve of World War I, there was really pronounced anxiety in Berlin about Germany's trajectory for a couple of reasons. One, Germany, through its own assertiveness, had provoked a counterbalancing coalition anchored by Russia, France, and the United Kingdom. And that coalition was first pursuing basically economic containment policies vis-a-vis Germany, making it harder for Germany to get access to vital resources that it needed. But it was also arming itself to an extent that German leaders really feared that the military balance of power was getting away from them. The Russians, for instance, were increasing the size of their army and improving the railroads that would allow them to mobilize that army in the event of war. And so by the time you get to the summer of 1914, when World War I breaks out, there is very much a now-or-never mentality in Berlin, a sense that if we don't act to defeat our enemies and break up this coalition around us now, we may lose the opportunity to do so forever. And that's one of the reasons why Germany knowingly takes so many terrible risks in July 1914 that helped bring on the First World War.
So your book looks back at what facilitated the rise of China over the past 45, 50 years. What have been the most important inflection points?
So when we think about China's rise, this is a story that has been happening for a couple of generations now. And so if you were born, as I was, in the 1980s, you've only lived in a world in which China has been rising. But that rise was not a miracle. It was not something that just happened. It came about as the result of a confluence of a handful of really important factors that just allowed China to take off in a way that it had not before. You asked about turning points. One of those is the turn to economic reform and opening in 1978, when Deng Xiaoping essentially consolidates his control of the Chinese political system and takes China down this path. This was a turn away from the autarkic economic policies that had prevailed for most of Mao Zedong's period, and it allowed China to open up its economy to the world in a more significant way, to implement capitalist reforms that would basically turn China over time into what is now called a socialist market economy. The reason that worked, though, is that it came in concert with a handful of other factors. China was demographically primed for productivity. It had a very large working age population that didn't have many kids or elderly parents to take care of. It was more or less self-sufficient in a lot of the resources it needed for growth. It had a political system that was always autocratic but became somewhat more responsive, somewhat more meritocratic in the 30 years after Mao's death. And it had a world that was willing to welcome China and to assist its rise. The United States started doing this in the 1970s as part of the Cold War calculus of ganging up on the Soviet Union. And the United States and other democratic countries continued to do this after the Cold War in hopes of engaging China and bringing it into the world. And so when you put all of these things together, there was a very fortuitous convergence of trends that allowed China to grow in a very fast, very sustained way that made it the economic power we know today.
How important was the decision to make it part of the World Trade Organization?
It was very important. And so the decision to bring China into the WTO actually comes relatively late in the engagement process. And so the United States had made it a policy objective to help China develop and modernize its economy going back to the late 1970s. But it was very important because it created a more stable atmosphere for foreign commerce and foreign investment in China. And it meant that China no longer had the threat of having privileged trade access to foreign markets yanked away from it on an annual basis. And so it really did help ignite the Chinese manufacturing boom that we have heard so much about in recent years, and it played a very important role in China's economic ascent.
So many of the countries that are now concerned about China's rise and its ambitions fueled it.
That's exactly right. And so this is one of those things where in some ways we have only ourselves to blame, although I think that the reasons that the United States undertook the engagement policy in the 1980s and 1990s made a lot of sense. At the time, it made a lot of sense to try to have an economically strong China as an ally against the Soviet Union in the Cold War. I think it made sense to see if we could bring China into the international system and thereby make it more reconciled to that international system over time. And so I think the problem wasn't so much that the engagement policy was tried by the United States and other democratic powers. It was that it went on for about a decade after it was clear that it wasn't producing the desired results.
How big a factor was Western greed?
I think it was a huge factor. And so when we talk about greed, we're simply talking about the desire of actors within Western societies to make money by doing business with China. In general, that's a good impulse. It's an impulse that we should want to encourage. It's an impulse that has helped fuel American foreign policy for centuries. The challenge was that as more and more important economic actors within American society, within European societies, developed deep stakes in engagement with China, it became harder and harder to change the policy over time. And so even now, when the United States considers measures to restrict some aspect of its technological or economic or financial relationship with China, you'll see concerted lobbying against it by firms and individuals whose own economic livelihood would be impacted by that. And that's the natural functioning of our system. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. but it did compete with the need to move towards a stronger geopolitical stance vis-a-vis China.
So as China became wealthier, let's talk about the ways that it started to deploy that capital. I wanted to break them down into sectors. First, militarily.
So China is engaged in what has to be one of the largest peacetime military buildups in history. It goes back really to the early 1990s. The Chinese saw how well the United States performed in the Persian Gulf War against Saddam Hussein in 1991 and really took that lesson to heart. And over the subsequent 30 years started building and continued building a military that was ultimately meant to give China the ability to prevail in a conflict with the United States in the Western Pacific. There's a lot of attention paid to China's anti-access area denial capabilities, as they are called. These are basically relatively cheap, relatively plentiful weapons that can be used to keep U.S. aircraft carriers, for instance, away from China's shores and make it harder for the United States to project power into the region. We're talking about anti-ship missiles and things of that nature. What we've also seen, though, is that China is increasingly developing a very robust power projection capability of its own. And so China is building aircraft carriers now. It's building more of a blue water navy. It's building more long-range bombers. It's investing in basically a military basing infrastructure outside of the Western Pacific in places like Djibouti and the Horn of Africa. And so China is certainly trying to become the dominant military power in the Western Pacific. It also clearly has ambitions to become a global military power over time.
How about in the domestic economy? We've seen these videos that have come out of China, these enormous building projects that they've been engaging in the past 20, 25 years.
So there is a lot of productive infrastructure investment in China, and there is a lot of unproductive infrastructure investment in China as well. And so you'll sometimes hear Western journalists who go to China talk about how great the bullet train is and how great the infrastructure within a couple hundred miles of the Chinese coastline is. And in many cases, that's true. But you also see lots of cases in where China has basically just force-fed capital into the economy by sponsoring construction projects that really don't amount to much. The most famous example of this would be the ghost cities, basically large cities that are only partially inhabited or mostly deserted simply because they can't be accommodated by the citizens that would be needed to fill up the place. And so you see evidence of both of these things in China. And unfortunately, it's become clear over time that more and more capital is just being put to less and less productive uses.
How have they deployed capital for international influence?
In a variety of ways. And so one way that has gotten a lot of attention is the Belt and Road Initiative, which is basically a multi-continent project that involves loans and infrastructure projects that's essentially meant to pull large swaths of Eurasia, but then also regions beyond Eurasia, into China's economic orbit. And so you sometimes hear about this when it pops up in the news, when China will make a loan to Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka can't repay the loan, and so then China ends up with effectively control over a Sri Lankan port. Things of that nature is often called debt trap diplomacy, although there's some controversy around how intentional that is. You also see it through something called the Digital Silk Road Project, which is a part of BRI, and basically involves an effort to more or less to wire the world, to lay the infrastructure that will make up the world's 5G telecommunications networks, to build smart cities and continents around the world, and basically to bring more and more countries into China's technological orbit.
That's the Huawei Corporation?
Huawei plays a very important role in that. There is a lot of ambiguity surrounding Huawei's ties to the Chinese government, but it has become increasingly clear that the Huawei acts as an extension of the Chinese state.
You also write about a billion-dollar toolkit that China has deployed to exert its influence more surreptitiously around the world. Would you talk about that?
So this is essentially the anti-democratic toolkit. And so when we think about countries that intervene or interfere in other countries' political processes, we often think of Russia and its role in the 2016 election in the United States. What's interesting, though, is that China has become much more active in trying to tarnish the image of democracies and even interfere with the functioning of democracies around the world. And so a couple examples of this would be The rampant disinformation that China put out regarding the origins of COVID and the effectiveness or lack thereof of other countries in dealing with it. And that wasn't simply sort of sticking it to other countries. It was a way of putting out the narrative that China's autocratic system had dealt with this problem effectively in a way that Western democracies could not. You see it deployed even more coercively in cases like Australia. So in the fall of 2020, the Australian government supported a call for an international inquiry into the origins of COVID. This was very sensitive for the Chinese. And so they responded by slapping economic sanctions on Australia and demanding things that really would have amounted to the stifling of civil society and free speech within Australia, shutting down or censoring newspapers and think tanks that were deemed to be anti-Chinese. For instance. And so you see that as China has developed more and more coercive capability, it's more and more willing to wield that to stifle free speech, not simply at home, but abroad.
So now you say the shoes are starting to drop on these policies. What is the timetable, and where will we see some of the evidence of those drop shoes?
I think we're already seeing evidence of drop shoes when it comes to China's foreign relations, for instance. And so there is dramatically more resistance, open resistance, to the expansion of Chinese economic and political and military influence now than there was 5 years ago or 5 years before that. You are seeing more and more countries and more groups of countries come to the conclusion that they cannot allow China to become the dominant power in Asia or globally. And so they are willing to do more to work together to prevent that from happening. There are a few examples of this, and so we've seen the reemergence of the Quad, which is basically a group of four democratic nations, India, Australia, Japan, and the United States, that even though they rarely say the word China, all they are doing is cooperating in the defense realm, in the public health realm, in the diplomatic realm, and a variety of other places to ensure that China doesn't set the rules of the road in Asia in the coming decades. You've seen this in initiatives like AUKUS, the US-UK-Australia deal to build submarines and otherwise improve their military capabilities in the Indo-Pacific. You're seeing it in the way that NATO and the G7 and other groups that are made up of largely non-Asian democracies, so countries that aren't even located in China's neighborhood, have increasingly taken an interest in pushing back against the exertion of Chinese influence. And you see it in the way that you're getting sort of informal alliances of countries that come together around particular technologies to ensure that China doesn't attain dominance in those areas, semiconductors, for instance.
If the domestic economy has been fueled by Chinese investment around the world, when are the bills going to come due on that, and what will be the impact on its society?
So I think that the bills are coming due already in a variety of ways. And so you can see this in a handful of different respects. And so in one way, you know, we often forget when we think about the Belt and Road Initiative, for instance, that a lot of those loans are what we would call bad loans. They are loans that are never going to be repaid in full and perhaps not be repaid at all. And so when those loans start coming due, mostly in the latter part of this decade, China is going to face some pretty unpleasant choices. It's either going to have to accept write-downs in the value of those loans at precisely the time that its own economy is going to be struggling. That's not going to be particularly popular with the Chinese domestic audience. Or it can insist on full repayment or something close to full repayment, which is going to make it pretty unpopular throughout the developing world, which is where many of these loans have been made. And so this is going to pose a real dilemma for Chinese statecraft. And Beijing may increasingly find itself caught between a rock and a hard place on the issue.
How did COVID impact these changing attitudes about China?
I think COVID probably did more than anything else to harden international attitudes toward China. There are a variety of organizations that have done great global opinion polling on this. And what you can see is that in the year or so after March 2020, international positive views of China just fall off a cliff, particularly when you're talking about advanced democracies. So advanced democracies in Europe and in Asia, in the Americas, favorability ratings decline, perceptions of China as a threat go through the roof. You can see this in the Trump administration's own policies toward China. I think up until early 2020, the Trump administration had been divided, ambivalent on how to deal with China. President Trump often seemed fixated on simply getting a better trade deal with China, whereas many of the folks who made up his administration really did see China as a significant national security threat. And the administration pivoted very hard toward the latter perspective in the last year of Trump's presidency, in large part because of the effect of COVID. And so in many ways, what we're seeing today is a reaction to COVID, but also to the extent to which China was seen to increase its own international aggressiveness and assertiveness during COVID by ramming fishing boats in the South China Sea, by applying more pressure on Taiwan, by starting a big border scrape with India that left 20 people dead, by pursuing wolf warrior diplomacy all around the world. This had more of an effect in terms of waking up the world to the China challenge than anything that U.S. leaders had said before.
Earlier, you talked about China having favorable demographics during its rise, but there's another shoe that's dropping on them.
That shoe is dropping as well. And so, you know, there's a debate underway about when exactly China's population is going to peak and begin to decline. It may already have happened last year. It may be a year or two away. But the short way of saying this is that China is on the verge of one of the worst peacetime demographic implosions in history. Essentially, the bill for the one-child policy, which was in place for decades, is coming due. And there just aren't enough, there are not going to be enough young workers to take the place of the generation that is aging out now. And so what you're basically going to see is that the number of senior citizens, the number of retirees in China is going to skyrocket over the next 15 to 20 years, and even going out beyond that. And the working age population is going to shrink. And this is going to create some real dilemmas for China as well. It's going to place extreme strain, for instance, on the social security network, because you're going to have fewer and fewer workers caring for more and more retirees. Think of the social security challenges that the United States has on steroids. That's the challenge that China is going to face, and it's going to exert greater strain on the political system as well.
Is it a coincidence that the Chinese population has become more nationalistic over the past decade or so?
No, I don't think it is, and I think it relates to a couple of different factors. And one of these things is just the oldest story in the world, which is that as countries become more powerful, they and their populations tend to become more nationalistic. If you can't do anything about an insult that is delivered to you, you may shrug it off. If you can do something about that insult, you may not be inclined to shrug it off. And so as China has become more powerful, say, over the past 30 years, you have seen this surge in that popular nationalism, which does appear to be genuine. Now, at the same time, it is often whipped up by the regime for instrumental purposes. And the stoking of Chinese nationalism has been a really important part of the CCP's program to maintain domestic legitimacy. It's always been there. The CCP has always portrayed itself as the party that saved China from the century of humiliation, that put it back on the track it had been on when it was great. But it's become increasingly important since 1989, since Tiananmen Square. And so the Tiananmen Square killings really tarnished the CCP's image in the eyes of the population. And so since it was increasingly clear as economic reform proceeded that there wasn't a lot of ideological content left in Chinese socialism, the regime doubled down on nationalism instead and cultivated anti-Japanese nationalism, for instance, by bringing up some of the awful memories of the 1930s and the 1940s and by stoking anti-American nationalism as well. And so these two things have come together now, and they result in the Chinese nationalism that we often see.
Well, it's also an important point to talk about the coercive measures that the CCP deploys to keep people in line.
That's right. And so the Chinese Communist Party, it's difficult to tell how popular it actually is with the Chinese population. But Beijing isn't taking any chances. And so China has always invested heavily in the domestic repressive apparatus. By a lot of estimates, China spends more on domestic security issues than it spends on its military, for instance, and its military's foreign missions, certainly. And China has been essentially bringing a long-standing repressive program into the 21st century by investing in what's often called digital authoritarianism. And so this is the use of big data, of AI, to forge new tools of social control, tools that may be more subtle, for instance. And so China's social credit system is essentially meant to nudge people in the direction of conformity with the regime and its principles rather than having to use heavier-handed methods. But if you look at the places where Chinese repression is severe, out west in Xinjiang, for instance, what you see is that digital authoritarianism and old-fashioned authoritarianism go hand in hand. So you have ubiquitous sensors that are keeping track of the Uyghur population. You also have checkpoints and concentration camps and a lot of the things that we associate with the terrible totalitarian powers of the 20th century.
So why does the, I'll use the word persecution of the Uyghurs, fit into their master plan?
Well, you know, whether or not we would call it a master plan, it is certainly of a piece with a variety of elements of Chinese statecraft. And so one is just sort of the longstanding concern about how well China holds together as a nation, that there are longstanding ethnic cleavages, national cleavages in China. And so there has been a fear going back a long, long time that areas like Tibet or Xinjiang are not that well integrated into the greater China that the CCP has put together. And so you need to use a lot of repressive force to ensure that the forces of separatism, as China might call it, don't rear their head. At the same time, there is a connection to China's geopolitical objectives. And so Western China, is, and Xinjiang in particular, is kind of China's gateway to much of Eurasia. It's the area through a lot where a lot of the rail projects or the pipeline projects associated with the Belt and Road Initiative connect with the Chinese homeland. And so if you have severe domestic unrest there, it's not simply a domestic threat. It's a threat to the geopolitical projects that you are carrying out as well. And so a number of scholars have pointed out that the repression of the Uyghurs is actually of a piece with this geopolitical agenda that China's pursuing.
How about the Chinification of Hong Kong, which is accelerated?
I think this is another example. And so when China regained Hong Kong in the late 20th century, there was essentially a deal where China would allow Hong Kong to maintain a relatively unique, by Chinese standards, political system for 50 years after the fact. The CCP has now reneged on that deal and has more or less fully integrated China into a CCP-dominated order. And in one way, I think this is just indicative of why it's often difficult to deal with countries whose power has been growing, because as they become capable of tearing up deals that they signed a quarter century before, they may decide to do so when it suits their interests. It's also, I think, a pretty stark warning of what might happen in Taiwan if China is able to exert control of that island. And so for a long time, the promise was that if Taiwan unified with CCP-led China, you would have a one-country, two-systems model where Taiwan was basically able to maintain its own political traditions, its own democratic traditions, even as it was part of the People's Republic of China. I think that was always kind of a dubious and cynical promise. It's hard for me to imagine an authoritarian government living indefinitely with sort of a democratic enclave. And it's become very hard to sustain now, and I think it's driving a lot of increased Taiwanese skepticism of the mainland.
We have about 20 minutes left in our conversation with Hal Brown, so we're talking about his new book with Mike Beckley, Danger Zone, The Coming Conflict with China. Let's talk about Xi for a bit. He has just announced a bilateral with President Biden. He's got an important election, which he's changed the rules of the road for the power base. How important is he to the CCP's aims?
I think he is very fundamentally important. Now, I don't want to go too far. I think that the United States has a China problem rather than a Xi Jinping problem. And it is entirely plausible, in my view, that even if Xi Jinping himself had not come along, the United States would still be dealing with the challenges of a powerful but insecure China. And so in some ways, you can even say that Xi Jinping is as much an effect as a cause, that someone like him would have come along at some point in China's trajectory, even if it wasn't Xi Jinping himself. At the same time, he clearly plays a very important role in shaping China's geopolitical objectives and in pushing China to go harder and faster and trying to accomplish a lot of these objectives than it had in the past. While the turn to a more sort of statecraft actually predates Xi Jinping, he has done a variety of things that have sort of put this into overdrive. And so domestic repression has really gone into overdrive under Xi Jinping. You've seen a return towards a more ideological, almost neo-Maoist style of governance within China, one with some pretty strong neo-totalitarian leanings. And you've seen a China that is much, much more willing to court international friction and resistance on the international stage. You've also seen Xi Jinping say some things that lead a number of analysts to worry that he may increasingly associate his own trajectory with that of China in some fairly destructive ways.
A la Putin.
And so there has been, for years and years, when Chinese leaders were asked about the status of Taiwan, their answer was basically, we can wait. It's going to come back to the mainland at some point. If we have to wait a generation or 100 years, that's fine. Xi Jinping has tweaked the formulation in a very interesting way, where he's basically said the problem cannot be passed down from generation to generation. And as Xi Jinping has increasingly personalized the Chinese political system, as he's centralized more and more power in himself, as he's made clear that he's not going to abide by the term limits that were put in place after Mao's death, a lot of people have started to speculate that perhaps he means it should not be passed down to the next generation of Chinese leaders, meaning that the Taiwan problem needs to be resolved on his watch. Now, there's a degree of speculation involved here, but he's certainly become pushier on the Taiwan question by sending Chinese air and naval forces on very aggressive exercises near Taiwan's waters and airspace, and otherwise pushing the issue harder than prior Chinese leaders had. And then the last way in which I think Xi Jinping matters is in what he has done to the Chinese political system. And so we really do have a degree of personalistic rule unlike anything we've seen in China since the Mao years. Xi has basically decimated the ranks of leaders below him to ensure that a successor cannot emerge. He's made himself the so-called chairman of everything, putting himself at the center of China's most important political and military processes. And he basically appears to be on the path, if he's not already there, of turning this from kind of an institutionalized autocracy into a personalized autocracy. Perhaps not going as far as Putin has, but on the same trajectory. And the reason that is worrying, in my view, is that the more isolated, the more all-powerful an autocrat becomes, the more prone they tend to be to make big mistakes.
How old is he?
So he's pushing 70 now, and so there will be sort of a natural limit to how long he can stay in power. By the early 2030s, which is where we end his book, he's going to be in his early 80s, and he smokes, he's a bit overweight, and so he's got some risk factors there, but we're likely to be stuck with him for the foreseeable future.
So if Taiwan might be the crown jewel in his aspirations, for you, when you look at it, is it a case of not if, but when they make a more aggressive move?
I think China is going to become more aggressive and more risk-acceptant vis-a-vis Taiwan. I don't think that means that a big war over Taiwan is inevitable. I don't think that Xi Jinping is an irrational actor. I don't think that China cannot be deterred. I think that China is going to become increasingly tempted to use force on the Taiwan issue probably in the latter part of this decade, because the military balance of power will look pretty good from China's perspective during that period. The U.S. and its allies and Taiwan will not be ready for a Taiwan crisis at that point if current trends continue. And we could reach a point in Taiwan's political calendar where it becomes increasingly clear that more nationalists, even pro-independence forces, are ascendant, and that the KMT, which is the Taiwanese political party that's traditionally been more friendly to the mainland and more inclined to pursue peaceful unification, may simply be a spent force. And so if you pull all of those things together, that could create a convergence of circumstances in which Xi Jinping feels like he has the ability to use force to bring Taiwan to heel and feels like he has the need to do it. But that doesn't make it inevitable, because it also depends on what Taiwan does, it depends on what the United States does, it depends on what America's allies and democracies around the world do. And so my preference would be for us to treat this issue with a great deal more urgency, so that when Xi Jinping looks at the situation in 2025 or 2027, he says, nah, that's still too risky for my liking.
What exactly is the U.S. commitment to Taiwan?
It's an ambiguous commitment. And so the United States used to have a formal treaty alliance with Taiwan, with the Republic of China, from the 1950s until the end of the 1970s. We broke that alliance when we transferred diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing during the Jimmy Carter era. But then Congress responded by passing something called the Taiwan Relations Act, which has a variety of formulations in there about America's relationship to Taiwan and its interest in peace and security in the Taiwan Strait and the Western Pacific. And to make a long story short, the way that that document and then subsequent U.S. policy statements are often interpreted is that the United States would provide Taiwan with some assistance if it were the victim of an unprovoked attack by China. It is left unclear whether that would be arms sales, whether it would be direct military intervention, or something in between, but that the United States would not feel compelled to do so if it was a fight that Taiwan picked. And so if Taiwan were to declare independence from China tomorrow, something that Beijing has long made clear is its red line, or one of its red lines, the United States would not feel compelled to intervene in a fight that was seen to be provoked by Taiwanese actions. And so for a long time, the idea was that we were trying to practice dual deterrence. We were trying to deter both sides. We're trying to deter China from unilaterally changing the status quo in the Taiwan Strait through the use of force, and trying to deter Taiwan from unilaterally changing a delicate status quo in the Strait by changing the nature of its political relationship with Beijing and with the rest of the world. It is the deterring China piece of that that has become more prominent recently, because it's China that is rocking the boat in the Taiwan Strait. But the official framework of U.S. policy has not changed.
The Taiwanese are in the news now for beginning to ramp up its military investments.
That's right. And so there was just news last week, I believe, about a pretty significant bump, upwards of 10% in Taiwanese military spending coming for the next year. And that's good news. Taiwan's military has some impressive capabilities, but it's not nearly ready to defend the island in the case of either an all-out Chinese assault or something short of that, like a coercive blockade, a coercive quarantine. The challenge is that Taiwan has not always spent its limited defense funds on capabilities that would be most useful to it if China were to attack. And so what most American defense analysts and a number of Taiwanese defense analysts believe would be most useful is basically a strategy that tries to turn Taiwan into a porcupine, that turns China's anti-access area denial strategy against it by buying large numbers of small, relatively cheap things that can just inflict horrendous damage on, say, a Chinese invasion fleet as it comes across the strait. This shouldn't be that hard, by the way. Taiwan has geography that's very favorable for the defense. You've got to cross about 100 miles of very choppy water to get there. There aren't that many beaches you can land on. Taiwan has jungles and mountains and dense urban environments. It's very favorable to defense. And so if Taiwan goes all in on a strategy that involves buying anti-ship missiles, mobile air defenses, drones, sea mines, preparing a population for prolonged resistance, developing a meaningful reserve or territorial defense force in the way that Ukraine has used so effectively in the current war, it can make itself a very tough nut to crack. The problem is that for a variety of reasons, Taiwan has continued to invest a lot of money in what's often called prestige capabilities. So expensive airplanes, expensive ships that will probably get killed on the first day of war with China.
So your goal with Mike Beckley in writing this book is to incite discussion amongst policymakers and still, as you said earlier, a greater sense of urgency. So first of all, is skepticism of China, concern about China, bipartisan consensus at this point?
Yes, to a point. And so you would get nearly universal agreement on Capitol Hill with the proposition that China is a serious geopolitical challenge, probably the most serious geopolitical challenge the United States faces. I think you would get widespread support for the proposition that the United States should not allow China to become the dominant power in the Western Pacific. Where you get less agreement and less urgency is on the what should we do about it question. There have been some constructive moves recently in that direction, proposals to help Taiwan arm itself in a more constructive fashion, proposals to strengthen the American military posture in the Western Pacific. We're just not moving fast enough.
You have a series of prescriptives in the book about this, but you do start off by saying, run away from anyone who tells you the answer to a bellicose China is an Asian NATO or a new Marshall Plan. Why?
Well, we're always tempted to simply try to rerun the playbook that worked last time. And the last time in this case would be the Cold War against the Soviet Union, when the Marshall Plan and NATO were essential elements of a U.S. policy that worked wonderfully well over the course of about 40 years. The problem is that the context is just dramatically different. There's a very good reason why there is no Asian NATO, which is that the geography and the history of the region is different. And so whereas a multilateral alliance made sense in Europe, it did not make sense in the Western Pacific. Would we like to have a multilateral defense organization in the Western Pacific? where 4, 6, 10 countries pledged to come to the aid of Japan or Taiwan if they were attacked by China, yeah, probably we'd love to have it, but we're not going to get it anytime soon. Similar things with the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was brought about to address a very specific problem, which was slow post-war reconstruction of Europe and the near-catastrophic collapse of Europe's economy in the winter of 1946-47. It's just a different challenge that we face vis-a-vis China today, and so we need to be creative in thinking about solutions.
So here's, and we have 8 minutes left, and these are big topics, but here's the list from your book. Aggressively hack digital authoritarian systems undermining their effectiveness. Slow the spread of repression-relevant technology, producing affordable alternatives to Chinese telecom and smart city technology. Partner with developing countries, incentivizing companies to move telecom production from China to India. Have greater military presence in the air, bring more allies into the fight, and leave a way out since definitive victory is not likely. I wanted to use the time by, every day I pick up the newspaper, a national newspaper, and there is a different angle on the China-U.S. story. And I wanted to close by citing some of those and see how they play into your prescriptives.
Sure. So maybe we can just talk, because we've been talking about Taiwan, about some of the military dimensions of this. And so the way I would frame this is that the direction of travel in U.S. policy has been about right. It's just that the speed of travel has not been adequate. And so if you go down the list of things that we recommend, helping Taiwan up-arm itself with the capabilities that we talked about, thinking about deploying extra air and naval assets in the Western Pacific, changing America's basing posture in the region so that we're not so heavily concentrated at a handful of bases that would be extremely vulnerable to a Chinese first strike using missiles and aircraft. In a lot of cases, we're not exactly reinventing the wheel. These are things where I think serious defense analysts have looked at the problem for a number of years and identified what we need to do to make the U.S. military more effective, to make the Taiwanese military more effective if China does use force in the region. The challenge is that for a variety of reasons, bureaucratic inertia, competing priorities, a variety of other things, we've just been slow to implement this. And that was a luxury that we had in 2005. It was a luxury that we had in 2015. It's not a luxury that we have in the second half of 2022 when some of the scenarios we're talking about are only 2 to 3 years ahead. The other thing that I think has not gotten enough attention in the defense debate is the question of how a war involving China might actually end and how long it would last. We focus a lot of attention on what a Chinese attack on Taiwan would look like in the first week or two of the fighting, how the United States would respond, how it would try to surge military capabilities from other regions to turn the tide. I think, though, it's extremely unlikely that a war over Taiwan would end quickly. I think it would drag on for months or years because both sides would have the ability to keep fighting and they would have the incentive to keep fighting. And one thing we know from history is that when great power wars go long, they tend to get messier, they tend to get bigger, and they tend to get more dangerous. And so this is why a lot of our emphasis is on, let's think about how we can deter a conflict with China, because actually having to fight it would be disastrous.
How concerned are you about a China-Russia relationship?
I think it is a serious concern, and I think it is fair to say that the Washington, D.C. policy establishment has, over a period of 2 decades, consistently underestimated how close and how productive that relationship would become. We often told ourselves that these countries were rivals historically, that they have a long land border, that they will struggle to get along for a variety of reasons. And all of those things may be true over a 20-year time horizon, but they're not true today. We're seeing more and more Chinese military, economic, political, diplomatic cooperation with Russia. I expect that to increase significantly as a result of the Ukraine war, which is going to make Russia far more dependent on China. And this has really important strategic effects. The fact that China can essentially denude its border with Russia of military capabilities in the same way that Russia has done during the Ukraine war means that it can focus more on the primary enemy, which is the United States and its group of allies and friends in the Western Pacific. And so it produces real benefits for Russia and China and real dilemmas for the United States.
In the couple minutes we have left then, what is the most significant thing the United States and its allies can do to blunt Chinese aggression?
I think the most significant thing they can do is to tighten the ties between them when it comes to pushing back against Chinese aggression. I think that it would be a daunting prospect for Xi Jinping to undertake a war against Taiwan and the United States. I think it would be near suicidal for him to undertake a war against Taiwan, the United States, Japan, Australia, maybe the United Kingdom, maybe a couple of other countries in the region. Wherever China is acting assertively, we want China to feel as though it is meeting with concerted pushback from a coalition of like-minded powers. I think that's particularly important in the military realm as we try to influence Xi Jinping's calculus, but you could make the same point about the technological competition or anything else. There really is strength in numbers here.
Do you think Xi would look at Putin's war in Ukraine and take any lessons away from it?
He's certainly taking lessons from it. What those lessons are, we just don't know. He might take away the lesson that he should be really cautious about initiating a big war because it could go really badly for him, as it has gone for Putin. He might take away the lesson that if you're going to start a war against Taiwan, be sure you do it decisively and win in the first 3 days before the United States and other countries have a chance to respond. The Chinese political system has always been a little bit of a black box. It's all the more so today, which makes it hard to understand exactly what he's thinking.
I'm going to close on a personal note, if you don't mind, because history is a family business, and your father has been featured many times in history projects on this network. So tell me how it is that you ended up going into the same field.
Well, I guess the,
I should say that he's H.W. Brands, a frequent visitor to C-SPAN programs.
And it's funny, we were just talking about this yesterday, in fact. I guess the short answer is that when I was growing up and looking for things to read, all the books on the bookshelf were about history. And so that sort of cultivated an interest. And then after I tried out every other college major, I realized that was what I actually loved. And so it's been great to have him as someone I can go to for advice and insight over the years.
Well, we're glad to have you on this network as well. Thank you for the last hour of your time. Hal Brand's book, along with Michael Beckley, is Danger Zone, The Coming Conflict with China.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A. And subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.